Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. Well, today we're going to be talking baseball. Yes. You know, history has so many fabulous people that have done so much in the area of sports. And I didn't know anything about this man. His name is Chief Bender. And the book we're going to be talking about is the story of this man who is a Native American who is in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And the book is titled Chief Bender's Burden. Tom Swift is my guest, and he's the guy that found out a whole bunch about a very, very brilliant and talented man. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Donna.
Well, I'll tell you, before we went on the air, I was making the comment to you, one, I didn't know anything about Chief Bender, but two, this man was incredible for his era. I mean, I think even in today's ball games, he would just be astonishing.
Well, you know, you're not alone as being someone who doesn't know the name or know his story. History seems to have really to a certain degree, skipped over him in that he is immortalized in the Baseball Hall of Fame. But I think that to a large degree, he has not been recognized for his accomplishments on the field, especially the fact that he accomplished what he did in the face of so much prejudice. But just talking about him as a person in general, yeah, he was really impressive. He was a very bright man, one of those kind of guys who was always thinking. And as you said, I think that he would have fit into just about any era because probably his greatest strength was his mind. He adapted to his environment and used his skills based on the opponent at hand. He's very much a thinking man's pitcher and very much a kind of a Renaissance man, if you will.
Yes, and I like that description because I felt it was very appropriate. Now, you yourself are an award-winning journalist. You do freelance writing, and you're a member of the Society for American Baseball Research. Tom, why do you have such a passion for the game?
Well, you know, I like as you were talking about in the introduction there. I like history. I like hearing about men and women, the people who did unique things in the past, and baseball itself has just such a rich history, and the Society for American Baseball Research is an organization that is very much dedicated to preserving and recognizing stories like the story of Charles Bender and many other players. And so I would say that for me, I came to this book and to this story more for the human interest angle, honestly, than I did for the baseball. Now, Bender was an exceptional baseball player, and I never would have heard of his name if I was not a baseball fan. But for me, I can honestly say I probably wouldn't have written the book had he been just a great baseball player. These other aspects of his story that you were alluding to, and is really as much of why I wrote this book as any, you know, set of box scores or game accounts, if you will.
You have a description of him where you said he had very, very thin legs, but he had tremendous strength in those legs. And when he got up to do a pitch, you describe his glove trailed behind his back like the tail end of an airplane, and his throwing hand looked like it was pulling down a window shade. He kicked so high, which was a signature of his motion, that as he strode towards the plate, a batter could see the bottom of his left foot. Now, this guy had a powerful, powerful pitch.
Yeah, he was one of the first pitchers to really be known for that high leg kick that you just described there from the book. And you know, I talk about his intelligence, and I'll probably keep coming back to it, but it's so much a part of really everything that he was about and why he was so successful. But I think what he really did is he was very efficient in that he seemed to get as much power out of his body as his body would allow. And I think he was the kind of guy who got by on changing speeds and trying to and using exceptional control. But he also could throw the ball pretty hard, and that was really a function of him making the most of his delivery.
It was said by sports writer F.C. Lane in Baseball Magazine that when it comes to pitching an individual game, there is no one equal to Bender. What is so fascinating about that time frame, and you mentioned it in the beginning when you started talking about the prejudice and how when a Native American was playing in a game, the nickname Chief went with almost all of them.
Yeah.
But with him, it stuck in a special way because he really was a leader.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there were. I talked to a man who remembers being in the same room with Bender, and I didn't use much information from him because of the number of years that have passed since that time. But one thing that kind of stuck with him was that, you know, that chief title which he got, which was ascribed to him and really every Native player of the time. Made fit in the sense that he kind of had that air about him, that he was in control of the situation. And that quote you were talking about from F.C. Lane, who was a pretty prominent sports writer in that time, really speaks to a big part of who Bender was, in that the greater the stakes, the higher the pressure was, the calmer he was, the better he seemed to pitch. He seemed to give a kind of a sense that he wasn't going to get rattled no matter how much pressure might be thrown at him, and that was just one aspect of his story, and really an aspect of him as a person that was just so fascinating to me. That here was this guy who faced a level of pressure that few of us, thankfully, have to deal with. And yet he seemed to thrive in those situations.
Now, he was 6'2".
Roughly speaking, yeah, about that tall. Yep.
And he had a very good posture about himself. He didn't like reporters very much. And, of course, when you think back to that time frame, you know that they had those huge cameras and they'd have the flash bulbs and people would try to get right up in your face, the reporters would, to be able to get pictures of you. And I had to chuckle because he was so good at controlling the ball that this one reporter was giving him such a time that he decided he'd practice a little bit and he pitched the ball against the camera's eye. He was that skilled. And of course, the reporter had to give up taking pictures for the rest of the day because, of course, the lens was broken. So you read something like this about someone and you go, well, gee whiz, how did he get to where he was so good? So let's go into his background a bit. Let's go into his childhood, his family, because his dad wasn't a particularly nice guy.
No, absolutely not. And the thing about it is that Charlie, as he was called as a boy, really wouldn't have gotten to know his father very well, at least certainly not after he was of school age. I think, you know, a lot of biographies of people who are famous, there isn't necessarily a lot of an interesting story before the person did whatever it was he or she did to become famous. In this case, Bender's story as a child, his school age years, to me, were this was something that I learned so much about in a general sense, looking at him, and really, I think, is a fascinating part of his overall story. He was, like a lot of Native children at the time, sent away to off-reservation boarding school at a young age. I mean, he went to a school in the Philadelphia area for 5 years, and then attended another school, you know, also in Pennsylvania for another 5 years. So 10 of his most formative years were spent in one or other of these boarding schools. And I get into the topic of those boarding schools in some length in the book, because it's just so important to at least try to understand what life was like at those schools. They were really harsh places for kids to be, and just surviving them was something of a feat. And here, Charlie did something more than that. I mean, he took what was around him and became, you know, he was kind of like a sponge. You know, he read a lot of books. He was really more of a student than he was an athlete at school. And the schools he went to weren't really known for producing great baseball talent. So he, you know, he really had a background that almost nothing about it pointed toward a life of celebrity, which is just, you know, another reason why I think his story is fascinating. It's just his success was just improbable for so many ways and for so many reasons.
Now, he was born, something we haven't mentioned, we're talking about a man who was born, and we're not really sure about his birth date, if I remember correctly.
Well, we're not sure exactly the day of the year, but we're quite sure that it was 1884. There was some reports later, if you look at a lot of his newspaper articles about him, that he was born in 1883, but I scoured a number of census records and consulted some other research that had been done that I note in the back of the book, and so we were pretty confident he was born in 1884, but as you said, we don't know exactly his birth date.
So we're talking about the early 1900s, when baseball was one of those few events that people really would get excited about. I mean, it was really a big deal. They didn't have television then. It was a whole different world than what we know today.
Absolutely.
And when you think about the times, most Americans at that time, when it came to education, they were lucky if they were literate.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
And that is something I don't think many people are aware of, that in the early 1900s, that a good portion of the population in the United States was illiterate. So as a Native American, it was his good fortune to have come in contact with a man, Richard Henry Pratt. And I've read all kinds of things about Pratt, how he had attitudes about the Indians, etc. But in your book, you said he did not believe Indians were inferior.
No, he believed that they could be educated. What he didn't believe is that their traditional ways were not going to work any longer. That, like it or not, kids like Charlie needed to be educated in white way, you know, in
mm-hmm.
white schools, so that they could assimilate into the dominant culture. Yeah, he spent no small amount of his time and energy, Pratt, in trying to start and then run his school, and so, as you mentioned, Charlie received more education than the average person at the time, which, you know, was very ironic that he was often looked at as some sort of unrefined savage and maybe his success was due to genetics or these sorts of things, when really most of the time the people who, you know, in most cases he probably had more education than some of the newspaper reporters who were writing those things in their columns.
Yes, and I think at that time, too, because there had been so much change that had occurred culturally. When you think back with the Native Americans, it wasn't that long a period before everything that they had known. So many tribes, it was literally taken away from them.
Absolutely.
So here they are in a state of cultural shock. This isn't something that's evolved over 150, 200 years. This is something that really came down on them fairly quickly, and the adaptation by the younger generation was very, very harsh because of the fact the adults didn't have time to adjust to it. So if the adults can't adjust that easily, how is it going to be much better for the kids? And, of course, having the schools the way they did was one thing, and that was an opportunity for them. And, of course, out of the same school, out of the same environment, there were was Jim Thorpe, and there were so many others. But with Bender, when we step back in time, and I love this information, in 1914, general admission tickets, eat your heart out, folks, for those of you to go to ball games, the tickets were 25 cents, grandstand tickets were 75 cents, reserved seats were a dollar, ho ho ho, and the World Series, the teams were allowed to charge $5 for box seats, with other reserved seats at $3 and $2, and general admission bleachers for $1. Those were the days when the kids would be able to crawl in and do things that they wouldn't be able to get away with today. I mean, baseball was an entirely different environment than what we have in today's world. And you present this so well in your book, Chief Bender's Burden. And I looked at this, when you were doing this research about this man, what was it that really grabbed to you, your heart and your spirit? Because you've given so much in the book. I mean, you have all of these details about the game, the various people, the different historical things that went on. Why? There's such a feeling you have in this book. What touched you the most when you were doing this research on Bender?
Well, there were a couple of things, and thank you for saying that. I just feel like the prejudice and the racism that Bender faced is something that I don't think people, those of us who do look at baseball history, or even just, I think this is really American history, as you said, baseball was the thing in those days. We rightfully acknowledge some of the difficulties and hardships and just embarrassing details surrounding what say Jackie Robinson and some other players had to face when they broke the color line, and rightfully so that we acknowledge all those things, and I think because Bender was allowed on the field, Native American players weren't barred, so the analogy is not the same, but he had to withstand just so much racially charged ridicule just to do his job, it was on the field and off, where there was seldom that you read a newspaper article about Bender, even when he was at the top of his game and pitching in World Series, big World Series games. There was seldom a time when he was written about, when his race was not a big part of the story, and seldom was that aspect of the story told in any sort of flattering way. And to me, people needed to, I hope people know more about what it is he struggled with. In addition to that aspect of the story, to me it's inspiring. I think of my childhood. I think of how fortunate I was to have the parents I did, and to go to the schools that I went to, and I think of how I would have dealt with living in the conditions that Charlie lived in some of the schools he went to, and I wouldn't have lasted a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
Here he did it for 10 straight years with no breaks, no summer breaks, so I find his story inspiring in that regard, and I think one that is underappreciated. And then just the last, the other part of it is just, I found him to be just a fascinating person. And to me, spending as much time as I did, both researching and writing, I had to not necessarily agree with or like every aspect of the person, but I had to have an appreciation for who he was and how he conducted himself, and I just find Bender to be a fascinating subject to write about.
You have in your book some very interesting statements. You talk about the vulgarity and the violence of the 1890s, which kept some fans from the ticket booth, but it made way for an amazing number of cultured men and authentic characters. And you have this paragraph, and it brings to mind someone that I knew many years ago. I had the privilege of broadcasting with him, who was an ardent sports fan on so many levels. His name was Steve Agbaba, and he was one of the fastest talking human beings I've ever met in my life, and baseball was a real passion of his. But we hear in your book, you said, whatever their academic records, players of this time had baseball smarts and were given more freedom to use their noodles. They implemented strategy without permission from the bench. Pitchers and catchers, for example, called their own games. Batters and base runners, rather than base coaches, flashed their own subtle signs to put a play on. Managers didn't micromanage. Real men knew when to bunt. And I read that, and it wasn't all that long ago, I heard someone talking about how they didn't enjoy football and baseball as much as they used to because they were micromanaged. And that statement, I think, is a very interesting one. Why do you feel baseball has become so controlled?
I guess the short answer that comes to my mind, or at least the thing that kind of, to be honest, makes me a little bit less of a fan today than maybe I was 5 years ago, is just everything seems to be based in and around money. Whether you're talking about the team trying to maximize profits, the television stations trying to maximize their advertising, the players worrying about the next contract. Now, I have to say that baseball has always been a business, and even in Bender's day, he wanted more money than he got, and players deserve to make a lot of money when a lot of money is being made. I'm not naive in that regard, but I don't think. That aside, it's still the case that I think this is true not just of baseball or even football, but other aspects of, and I won't try to broaden my opinion that way, but I think to other aspects of contemporary American society that the dollar is first and last in consideration and it was certainly a different time when Charles Bender was playing.
Now, Chief Bender, and for those of you listening, it's Chief Bender's Burden. If you have a young person that loves baseball, if you have anyone in your family or circle of friends that would be interested in reading a marvelous story about a significant player in the game that almost anybody, unless they're a historian, they don't even know this guy exists. And he's in the Baseball Hall of Fame. He is quite a guy. He was so good that he ended up working as an observer so that he could work with Connie Mack and give him inside tracks on what's going on and the best way to handle things. And you brought out a point about baseball, and for those of you that are fans, you may want to watch for this. He said, between pitches, a pitcher makes several motions that are almost unnoticeable to the casual observer, but they have meaning. So there's a sign language that's going on. Well, all of us know, I think, about the catcher giving a sign language to the pitcher and vice versa. But there's other things going along that most of us, unless we're around professional players, we may not be educated about. That was quite an interesting point.
Well, thank you. when I say that Bender was a fascinating subject, I have to just say that I feel so fortunate that when I started to delve into the research, I learned so many things about him that made for a more interesting story than I could have hoped would be there. And one of those things was that Bender had this exceptional eyesight, and so he helped the Philadelphia A's, his team, win games even on days when he wasn't pitching. He had this exceptional eyesight, and he would observe what the A's opponents were doing, in particular the pitcher that they may be facing that day. And he had the ability to kind of decipher that, okay, the opposing pitcher tends to, you know, say, rub his right leg before he's going to throw a fastball, or these sorts of things. And usually they were very subtle motions, and Bender worked out a system along with some other teammates to kind of pick up some of those subtleties, and it was yet another thing about his story that drew me to him. That here was a guy who wasn't just on his day off sitting on the end of the bench and counting the days until he'd pitch again. He was always thinking, always using his mind to help his team.
Now, in the 1913 World Series, and I hope I have the right one, so correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
He didn't let anybody walk in that game.
Well, he pitched in 1913. He would have pitched in multiple games. I know in that series he had exceptional control. I don't recall off the top of my head whether there was a game in which he had zero walks. It's entirely possible. I think in the series may have only had a couple, but my memory isn't quite sharp enough to remember exactly what his walk total was for each game.
I think the Giants were playing.
Yeah, the A's faced the Giants actually three times. Bender pitched in five World Series, and he pitched against the Giants in the World Series three times.
This is the one where he got a clipping from a friend where it said,
oh, yeah,
McGraw knows he can beat Bender and hopes that Mac will start with the Indians.
Yeah, it's a great story. I mean, just finding those nuggets like that, for me, when I read about baseball, I don't want to just hear a regurgitation of a play-by-play of every ball game. And I really tried, for better or worse, to make this book be something other than that. So I tried to look beyond just at newspapers, beyond just those involving Bender's starts. And I found that story about how he read the newspapers and he clipped one out in which John McGraw, the famous manager of the Giants, had mentioned before one of Bender's starts against them that he would be easy to hit that day, and Bender he stuck it in his wallet and he remembered it. I mean, he remembered it for years, and he used it to fuel his performance. He didn't get all riled up and start fights and those sorts of things. What he did is he just put that sort of insult, if you will, to use, and he pitched effectively, perhaps in part because of that.
Now, this is a man who played ball as long as he possibly could. He was still pitching, very much involved in so many ways. Ended up having physical problems towards the latter part of his life. But he was inducted in the Baseball Hall of Fame, and in 1972 he was inducted into the American Indian Athletic Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
But again, very few people know about him. Tom, you've done a wonderful thing with your book here, Chief Bender's Burden. And is there a website people can go to find out more about this fascinating man?
I have a website. It's tomswift.com with a hyphen between the Tom and the Swift. And they'll be happy to talk with readers via my website. And there's information about the book and et cetera there.
Thank you so much, Tom, for being
Donna,
my guest.
Thank you so much.
This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. Don't go away. We're going to be right back.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and telephone lines are now open. Our numbers here, if you'd like to call in and chat with me, are 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, we have a direct line of 530-876-3222. Now, for those of you that might be new listeners, all you need to do when you call in is give me your first name or your initial. Let me give you my perceptions as they come, and then you're welcome to ask me about anything that you like. Now, by the way, I have to say, I must apologize. My computer, I swear it got a severe attack of PMS. Don't ask me what's happened the past couple of days. I could no more figure it out than the man on the moon. I sent out my email, and I found out that my system did some kind of a burp, and instead of the September newsletter, the June newsletter went out. I've gotten quite a few emails on that one. I went, how did that happen? Well, don't ask me. I haven't a clue, because our system went down. And for those of you that were listening yesterday, you might be saying, yeah, it seems like it happened with a station, too. So something was going on, and someone sent me an email saying, Donna, Mercury's in retrograde. When something retrograded, I don't know what happened. So anyway, the September newsletter is going to be resent, so you will be receiving the correct one instead of the wrong one. And again, my apologies. I'm so sorry that that happened. I had no control over it. I absolutely have no clue as to what went wrong. But there we are. We live in an electronic age, and those things happen. Well, I wanted to share with you some different things today, and what I'm going to be starting out with is a story by an individual, Victor Knox. And I believe in synchronicity. I believe that there is a rhythm. Have you ever noticed when you go about, when you sort of just let go and go with the flow? That's a very popular cliche, but I find it's one that really works. Have you ever noticed that when you get into that flow, and it's difficult to describe, but when you experience it, things just move with a synchronicity that's unbelievable? Well, this is what happens to so many people in so many different experiences. And I wanted to share Victor's because I think it can Well, touch our thinking and maybe our hearts and minds in a special way. He was getting ready to have some eye surgery. And, of course, anytime you go in for eye surgery or any kind of surgery, you're going to be a little apprehensive. But let's be honest. It's not something that we can always go in feeling, gee whiz, this is absolutely wonderful, and I'm not going to be concerned at all. This is something we all will have a concern about at one time or another. Well, he had a friend and a neighbor by the name of Dick who was going to drive him, and they were going to a clinic in Cleveland that was about 90 miles away from home in Lexington, Ohio. Now, obviously, after the eye surgery, he's not going to be able to drive with a bandaged eye. And his wife, Peggy, wasn't used to driving in big city traffic. So the friend, Dick, had been suggested. And she said, you know, he's always driving everywhere to football games. So he said, that's really true. Dick was a huge football fan. He'd drive hours just to see his favorite teams. He had a real passion for the sport. He knew everything about all of the big stars, and he just loved finding out about the college players that had been put on to their favorite team, or his favorite team, the Cleveland Browns. Well, Dick, of course, was more than happy to drive Victor, and Victor was trying to figure out, how can I express my appreciation to my neighbor, to my friend, for, you know, going out of his way to do this for me? Because he had to get up, sunrise, sit in the hospital waiting room for me all day, and there wasn't even a magazine there for him to read. So Dick decided he was going to get up and walk around because he hadn't brought anything with him. So Victor's feeling a little uncomfortable with this, and he knows that Dick is bored, and he's thinking, well, this is really going to be tough on this guy. Well, he had talked to his wife about this, and she said, don't worry about it. We'll find some way to say thank you to Dick at another time. Maybe we'll get him a gift certificate or something. And the more Victor thought about that, he knew his wife was well-meaning, but he thought, no, that's not good enough. I just don't know what I can do. So he meditated on this, and then he became aware of, after a while, that it was taking Dick a long time to come back. Well, when Dick finally did come back to meet him, he just said, wow, Victor, I want to thank you. Now, Victor is the one that doesn't expect to have Dick thank him for driving him out there. He said, what do you mean, thank me? And he said, you will not believe. And, of course, Dick is grinning from ear to ear. He can hardly contain himself. He said, you won't believe who I met in the elevator. Brady Quinn. This guy was last year's quarterback for Notre Dame. He's here getting his team physical. He was just drafted by the Browns in the first round. I shook his hand, and I got to welcome him to Cleveland. Well, Victor went in for his surgery. The surgery went beautifully. Absolutely wonderful results. And he thought, I don't have to worry about saying thank you to Dick. He said he was so excited he couldn't stop talking about having met Brady Quinn. For days afterwards, he felt he had been given a gift. After all, if he hadn't driven Victor to the hospital, and if he hadn't have been bored, he wouldn't have been walking around and bumped in to this person that was so very important to him. Life does have its synchronicity, and I think that's one of the joys about living, is if you can have an expectation and just have that feeling inside of you that you don't know where something magnificent or special is going to come from, and you don't have to know, but you're sort of ready to greet it when it comes into your life. It makes a little bit of what I call magic dust in your everyday living. And I know some of you may say, Donna, oh, you're being just very whimsical and very Pollyannish. But there is something special about the sense of expectation. If there is that sense that you are going to have something good happen to you, it will. It is just I just can't explain it. It is absolutely a wonderful part of life. What we focus on attracts to us maybe what we don't want at times. And that's why being consciously present with how you're thinking and really looking at what's going through your mind and saying, wait a minute, do I want this stuff or I don't want this stuff? That's part of what's in my newsletter this month. Oh, no, you'll get the right one, by the way. The correct one is up on my website, but I'll be sending out the one via in the newsletter because it's a shift. And that's what I talk about in the newsletter. It's a shift. And it's taken me a lot of years for me to learn how to do this. And I can't say I'm perfect at it. It's always a work in progress. But there is that positioning there of choice, detaching oneself from what really you don't need to hang on to, what you don't need to own in the way of a negative feeling or a negative response or negative circumstances. And I was just saying something to someone this morning, this too shall pass. They were going through a real tough time, lots of stress, and most of the stress they've admitted is their own making because they get very agitated easily over some things. And they're so intellectual that their mind goes off on all kinds of tangents. So just remember, when you find this, maybe pull yourself back mentally. Take a break. One gal I know, she goes into a bathroom. That's what she'll do. She'll go into a bathroom. She'll say, I got to take some deep breaths here. And she'll just calm herself down, look in the mirror and say, wait a minute, what am I giving energy to? What am I giving my attention to? What is my focus? And then sometimes she says, I'll say, you need a nap, kid. So whatever it is, you know, you may not be able to take the nap at the moment, but you can shift. You can shift from where you are. If you're scared about something, look at it. Really look at it. And the stuff you can't control, and this is a hard one to learn, the stuff when you can't control, you have to recognize that. That which you can control, then you work with that. Sometimes it's deep breathing. Sometimes it might be reading a book. Sometimes it might be talking to a friend. Sometimes it might be talking to yourself so that you make the shift and you get out of the blame game. So expect good things in your life. Expect them. Is there crap going on? You betcha. All kinds of it. But where do you want to be? Where do you want your mind to be? How do you want your actions to reflect out in life? What do you want there? How do you want to live your life? This is something you can have a choice over. You may not be able to control everything, but control what you can. And one of the biggest spaces that belongs to you, totally, completely, all-encompassing, is your mind. That's right, your mind. It's yours. It doesn't belong to anybody else. Often because of indoctrination, we will buy into somebody else's stuff until we have a chance to work through and find out what's right for us. And that may not mean that someone else's stuff isn't okay for them, but it means that you don't have to buy into it. That is a job. That is something that we have to think about. We have to evaluate. We have to measure and say, do I want this in my cup of life or don't I want it in my cup of life? It's really interesting. So remember, just like Victor's friend Dave, you never know where your good's going to come from. And I think that is absolutely wonderful. If you knew everything, wouldn't life be a little bit boring? If everything was the same? Oh, monotonous. So even when we have glitches, even when we have problems, when wrong stuff goes out, when it shouldn't go out and you need to amend it and you need to correct it, you know, 100 years from now, it won't make any difference. So, the show must go on, absolutely, but make it your show. Make sure that you take care of what you need to take care of and live in the moment. Live right where you are, right here, right now, because that's yours, and no one can take that from you. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break in just a moment. Hey, if you want to give me a call, let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Buzz me at 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. 1-877-159-7756 or 530-876-3222. By the way, when we come back, I think I'll have some astrological information to share with you. Other than that, give me a buzz if you'd like. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. All I need is your first name or initial, 877-876-5227, Canadians, 888-815-9756, or 530-876-3222. Well, we've got a great lineup of people next week that I want to tell you about. We're going to be talking with Chris Widener. The Art of Influence is going to be absolutely wonderful. And we are going to be chatting with him about how we can influence other people, influence our lives, and make a difference. Then Tim O'Brien, he's a repeat guest here on my show. He is going to be talking about a brand new publication with Ripley's, Believe It or Not. And I love stuff about by Ripley's because it is so different, unique. You just wouldn't believe what some people do and things that go on in the world. It's absolutely amazing. So Tim's going to be on with me on Tuesday. Then we're going to be talking about a subject that, wow, it's always been a close one to my heart, but to actually get the material on this, it's about the Mustangs that were saved at the White Sands Missile Military Base. Nobody's Horses, Don Hoglund, is going to be my guest. And so this is a powerful story, and it has just so much good information in it. I know you're not going to want to miss it. And then, John Pemberthy, to be or not to be. And when you say be, it's B-E-E. Yes, the busy bees. We're going to be talking about that. This is a wonderful story, very uplifting, very inspiring, and it is, if you will, a parable of type that I think is just great. And then we're going to be talking about a woman who did a great deal of scholarly research. In fact, she was recognized around the world for her scholarly publications. Her name is Frances Yates. I didn't know very much about Frances. I was familiar with her name, but really didn't know the background on this intriguing woman that was, my goodness, years ahead of her time in metaphysical understanding. But it's all about her and her involvement with the Hermetic tradition. So this is really going to be a fascinating week coming up. Tell your friends, and remember, if you miss any of the shows, just go to the archives, and you will be able to listen to them whenever it's convenient for you to do so. So, and also in my newsletter, I'm going to be giving information about my appearances coming up. I'm going to be in Alaska in a couple of weeks. I'll be in Fairbanks. I'll be in Anchorage. I'm also going to be in San Francisco coming up in October. We've just got so many things going on, and all of that will be in the newsletter. Also, I've got some other broadcasts. I've been invited to be a guest on certain shows, and I will be giving you information about that as well. So all of that is going to be listed. Well, how about a little astrological information here? This is lighthearted stuff. This is something that I just think is a lot of fun to do every quarter when I get the details. But let's talk about Geminis. We're going to give Gemini and Libra. If we have time for Scorpio, we'll do that too. But for those of you in Gemini, born under the sign of Gemini, September, you have got a good start. This is a good month for you. You know, it looks like some extra money is going to be coming in to you as well towards the end of the month. And you may find that this fall season can be very lucrative for you if you pay attention to all the signals. Now, in October, you may find that your pace will slow down a little bit. Don't be surprised if you have some upheavals, a few things that might cause you to feel like you've hit a few potholes in life. But, hey, it's just part of living. You'll get past it, and you're going to find that you're going to move along. I know we've got a caller, but let me finish this for Gemini. In November, you are going to be paying attention to everything that's going on around you, and you're going to uncover some information that you did not know existed regarding a particular individual you either have as a friend or as a working associate. It'll give you an insight into them so you can get things done the way you want to. So watch, look, and listen, Geminis. You've got a lot coming your way. Let's take our caller. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Arizona, and I called you yesterday, and there was some technical difficulty.
Oh, my goodness. Was there ever? We had such a mess. And what's even worse is that my whole computer system glitched. And if you're on my newsletter list, you got a new newsletter for June, which you weren't supposed to get. It's supposed to be September. I don't know. I think my computer just got a severe attack of PMS. Of course, I could be all wrong. If I remember correctly, you were getting ready to ask me a question.
Well, I was asking you about some houses that I'm looking at, and there's one in particular that I'm looking at and considering taking, and you started to respond that you saw it maybe not as the best, that I'd be thinking of it in terms of the best choice, but it sounded like it was going to be a good investment.
All right, you want to buy a place. What I'd like for you to do is really look at the economic positioning you're in right now. And let's say you could afford $500 a month, but you couldn't afford $1,500 a month. What I would say is look at what you're comfortable with financially, whatever that may be. And I just use the numbers I used because they were convenient. When you look at what is comfortable for you, where you're not going to be unduly stressed, then shop from that positioning. And don't fall in love with a house. Realize that your home is going to be wherever you are, wherever you choose to live. What you want to do is look for something that's going to fit comfortably within your financial budget, not require a heavy amount of fixer-upper stuff, and when you look at the neighborhood, it would be a comfortable, easy sell. So do your homework.
Okay.
Do your homework. I think it's good to own instead of renting. I think depending on your circumstances and your lifestyle, that's a very positive thing. But do your homework. Don't be in a real hurry with this, because you've got, in my estimation, a good buyer's market. You just need to shop around.
Okay.
And I know we're out of time, hon.
Okay, doke.
All right.
Thank you.
You are welcome. You have a fabulous day. And let us know about your house.
Thank you.
Okay, dear. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for calling in. This is Donna Siebel. I know that we're out of time here. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Life is exciting, and even with technology having its burps and bubbles as we go along in life, remember that what you do with what goes on really makes a difference. Smile. Life is good. There's a lot to be grateful for, and enjoy your journey. Even when you hit a few potholes, you'll get past it. I know I have. You will too. This is Donna Siebel. Have a fabulous weekend. We'll see you here, same time, same place, right here on BBSRadio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.